From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gralat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and I will talk about my trip to Brazil and the reaction and response to the Zika virus, as well as some of the health and security issues related to a lawsuit against the United Nations over a cholera outbreak in Haiti.
There really isn't a question that the United Nations is responsible for this and does have some culpability in dealing with the victims.
Then I'm joined by Joshua Landis and Middle East analyst Joseph Bahut to discuss Lebanon's relationship with Syria as the fifth anniversary of the civil war approaches.
If you have to take this approach of Sunni Shia fight in the region, which is today partly the lens that you have to take, it is really becoming a zero-sum game between Shias and Sunnis.
Another take on the country's half-decade-long conflict right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat. Rebecca Cruz, let's start by talking about Haiti. Now, Haiti's not been in the news for a while. We recall that nearly 6 years ago now, in 2010, there was a massive earthquake in Haiti, horrible, destructive earthquake. But we often forget what happened after that when the United Nations sent peacekeepers and sent people to come and help after the earthquake, that they brought with them cholera. And we're pretty certain that it was brought by these United Nations representatives. And so then there was a huge cholera outbreak. We talk about adding, you know, insult to injury or injury to insult, one of the two. But it killed 9,000 people and infected nearly a million. So now there's a group that's suing the United Nations on behalf of these Haitian victims for this outbreak. But this is a really controversial thing, suing the United Nations, suing peacekeepers, questions of immunity. What's going on here? And this is playing out, by the way, in an American court.
Yeah, as you say, there really isn't a question that the United Nations is responsible for this. It was probably peacekeepers from Nepal, and the United Nations has essentially said as much with their own research. The question is really about dealing with the many, as you mentioned, victims. Probably close to 10% of the population was infected by cholera during this time. And early on, there was a larger case that was brought forward on behalf of the 5,000 of the victims, and this was in 2011. And the United Nations completely rejected the claim, and they said that there was nothing that they needed to do or had to do. And so in response to that, we see a new case come up, and this is to take place, in, as you mentioned, in the United States, actually in New York. And this case is representing five of the victims that died, as well as their family members, some of them American citizens. So that's why we have jurisdiction in the United States, or that's what the claim was. In a lower court, this was struck down because in 1946, there was a convention on privileges and immunities. As the United Nations was getting created, it was decided that they needed to be treated as an individual, but that they needed to have immunity from these sorts of legal actions. Now, this was 60, 70 years ago that we're talking about, and what that actually means is being questioned here. So a lower court said there was immunity, but an appeals court is now saying that they're going to listen to this case and see if that really holds, because also, there is a responsibility within the UN Charter and other documents that the United Nations does have some culpability in dealing with the victims, and they have some responsibility in that regard. So what that looks like, we simply don't know.
Well, I mean, if nothing else, there should be procedures in place to prevent peacekeepers who might be infected with some sort of disease to come into a very unstable situation and create a larger problem. So, you know, whether this will be settled in this court, I guess some suggesting that this may end up in the U.S. Supreme Court, this question of immunity for the United Nations. But it seems to me there's some sort of negligence that happened here. I mean, just on the surface.
Well, that certainly seems to be the case, and we'll see what the trial turns out to be. But speaking of diseases and international bodies, and you just returned from Brazil, and Zika virus obviously has been in the news. You know, maybe tell us a little bit about what you experienced there. Is this a similar situation? What's going on here?
Right. Well, we had a great trip to South America, Chile, Argentina, and Brazil with OU alums. And so we end in Brazil. And of course, as we got closer and closer to Brazil, the discussion, the talk about Zika, of course, was increasing. There really aren't any cases in Chile and Argentina to speak of. And the weather just isn't right. It's just not likely to for them to have mosquitoes in Chile. We never saw a single mosquito. you know. But as we got closer and closer to Brazil, it became more of a concern. Everybody, of course, wanting to take precautions. You know, we went to Iguazu Falls, and of course, it's wet and humid. And so, you know, we started to take those precautions there. Lots of mosquito repellent and that sort of thing. In Brazil, we saw a lot more mosquitoes. But, you know, again, I mean, it's pretty relaxed, you know. I mean, the attitude there is one that it's really not the kind of emergency that has been portrayed
by the World Health Organization.
By the World Health Organization, by the CDC, by the media in general, really, you know, capitalizing on this story. I mean, obviously, all eyes are on Brazil right now because of the Olympics. So, I mean, they're spraying like crazy. You just really don't have the amount of panic and concern in country. But nonetheless, you know, everybody wanted to take precautions. We did take precautions. Everybody was fine. And we discussed at length with Brazilians and with our Americans and visitors about the consequences, the implications, the you know what to do and what would happen if you were to get Zika. But I have to say it was pretty relaxed, and the overall attitude about it, I mean, it was just much more calm than what you would see in the media.
Well, how interesting that you got to go at such an important time.
It was very interesting, really interesting to see them prepare for the Olympics and especially manage all of these issues. Well, thank you, Rebecca. It's great to be back in the studio with you, and I appreciate your insight on these issues.
Well, glad to have you back.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments on this episode in the Worldview section of KGOU.org, or you can tweet us at WorldviewsKGOU or at Suzek Rolat. The show is also available as a podcast through iTunes. After a short break, Joshua Landis joins me for a conversation with Joseph Bahut from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Geneva Center for Security Policy. We'll talk about how the Syrian civil war affects Lebanon. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. My guest this half hour is Joseph Bahut. He studies the politics of Lebanon and Syria and how the war affects the region at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Geneva Center for Security Policy. We are joined in our conversation by our regular contributor, Joshua Landis. Joseph Bahut, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'd like to begin, given you're from Lebanon and have spent a considerable amount of time in the region and an expert on Middle Eastern affairs, to talk a little bit about Syria, the crisis going on in Syria, and its impact on what's happening in Lebanon. Can you give us kind of the lay of the land as it looks right now?
Mm-hmm. In fact, what's difficult to understand about Syria is that it has become a real multi-layered conflict. You have several, let's say, levels of understanding. The first one is, of course, it started as a revolution like any other Arab revolution, society against a very authoritarian regime, and then it turned out to be a weaponized conflict between this regime and its society, and then a civil conflict or civil war between several clusters of this society, and then a proxy conflict which is regional and today international. This is why sometimes it's difficult to sort things out. Now, on the regional level, of course, Syria has become really a kind of cauldron that is today producing a lot of, let's say, nasty things for the environment. First of all, the refugee issue, which is becoming really alarming and appalling. It's more than a time bomb. It's a bomb now today, with more than 4 million people displaced outside the country and 4 inside the country, with also a lot of, let's say, interferences from the neighboring countries in the Syrian conflict under the form of sending fighters, weapons, money, things going out from Syria towards the neighborhood. And this is where, in fact, Syria is no more Syria. It is no more the conflict about Syria or a Syrian conflict. It has become really a regional conundrum and a regional crisis that is maybe threatening now with the Russian intervention to become an international crisis. So I think that understanding Syria needs to really look at all these levels, and really focusing on one of these levels could be misleading intellectually and probably politically also.
Now, we've heard a lot about Hezbollah. One-third of the population of Lebanon, Shiites. Some belong to Hezbollah. Hezbollah has entered into the Syrian civil war on the side of Bashar al-Assad and his state because, theoretically, they're Shiite or they're offshoots of Shiites, and Iran supports Syria, the government, and supports Hezbollah. But this is a third of Lebanon, in a sense, participating in the Syrian war. How do the rest of the Lebanese What are the Shiites doing, first of all? Why are they doing this? And what do the rest of the Lebanese think of this?
Yeah, first of all, when we talk about Lebanon and the numbers and the figures and the shares of communities and et cetera, we have to be very careful. One-third is a point of view. It's not a fact. It's very debated. We don't know what is exactly the demographics of Lebanon. Some people are saying that it is one-third of Shia, one-third of Christian, one-third of Sunnis. Others say that Sunnis and Shia are more or less equal, about 25% to 30%. So it's very difficult to sort out. So let's put that aside. There's no doubt that the Shia community today is probably the most powerful community in Lebanon in terms of demographics, in terms of political way, in terms of economics. This is without debate. Now, the second assumption is that all Shias are Hezbollah-oriented, which is also another assumption that is debatable. I mean, the Shia community is very diverse. Of course, in terms of electoral power, Hezbollah is today the main force because of many things that we don't need to enter into that. Now, to come back to your question, yes, without any doubt, Hezbollah has chosen to get into the Syrian conundrum and the Syrian cauldron completely. As of 2011, 2012, very, very early in the conflict. So, and this is a contradiction to what Hezbollah says, that it is only a reaction to the flow of jihadis and etc. It's not true. The Hezbollah chose to defend the regime as soon as the summer of 2011. But this aside, I think that what you are raising is a very, very interesting, very important question. What is at stake in Syria, I think it has become, and this has to do with what we were saying in the beginning, it has become, in fact, an existential conflict for a lot of forces in the Middle East. When you ask about why are the Shias putting their lot and casting their fate on the side of the Syrian regime, of course there's something, quote-unquote, religious, sectarian. They are more or less cousins in terms of Shiaism, Alawism, etc. But this is not the only reason. For Hezbollah, the potential of having the regime falling in Damascus and being replaced by more or less a Sunni force, be it radical, moderate, pro-Saudi, pro-West, pro whatever you want, is for them an existential threat in the meaning that, first of all, it will embolden the Sunni community in Lebanon and change the balance of power in the country. Second, it will cut off completely their supply line of weapons, money, influence, etc., that is going from Iran through Iraq, through Syria to Lebanon. And then also it is for them a danger of seeing what they call the axis of resistance, which is today very debatable, being put into question, and the end of probably the balance of, or change of the balance of power in the entire region. Exactly the same, symmetrically, you can see it for the Sunni communities that are also perceiving Syria as an existential threat. For them, the survival of the regime, of Assad's regime, means probably retribution against them and probably the end of their political existence in Lebanon, and maybe for some of them their physical existence. We have to remember the Hariri assassination thing. And for the Saudis and for the Sunni, let's say, axis in the region, curbing Iran in the Levant, after the loss of Iraq and after its hegemony over Lebanon, more or less, has to do with, in fact, completely debunking or breaking out the ring in Syria, i.e. putting down the regime. So for both communities, if you have to take this approach of Sunni-Shia fight in the region, which is today partly the lens that you have to take, partly, it is really becoming a zero-sum game between Shias and Sunnis. So it is understandable that the Shias of Lebanon are perceiving Syria as an existential issue or stake. Now, what is debatable is that a Lebanese faction that is participating in the political life, that is a main sayer in the government and the state, takes unilaterally the decision to go and defend a regime which is, in fact, opposed by, if not half, at least a big part of the Lebanese polity. So this is putting Lebanon at risk and under strain. And I don't know how much Hezbollah is, in fact, weighing this kind of risk.
We're speaking with Middle East political analyst Joseph Bahut about Syria's civil war and how it affects neighboring Lebanon. More after a break. I'm Suzette Guerlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Joshua Landis and I are talking with Joseph Bahut from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Geneva Center for Security Policy. When we left off, he described some of the multi-layered sectarian issues created by Syria's civil war and how it affects Lebanon.
How do the Christians respond to this? They see the Shiites in their effort to destroy, you know, Islamic radicalism. That's the way the Shiites, of course, describe it, as protecting Christians as well, or do they see it as undermining Christians?
You see, George, this is exactly the consequence of looking at only one layer of the conflict in Syria. In fact, for the Christians of Lebanon, the dilemma towards political change, towards authoritarian regime, towards freedom and democracy, towards ideals of rule of law and etc. is really preceding the Syrian revolution. It's not something new. Now, people are jumping into the Syrian case saying, okay, the Christians, I mean, by doing some very simplistic correlations, the Christians are afraid of Sunni radicalization. Who is fighting Sunni radicalization? Supposedly the Assad regime and Hezbollah. So the Christians are with Hezbollah. This is very simplistic and very late in the conflict. I mean, for example, for the Christians of Lebanon, first of all, in the beginning of the war, they sided with the Assad regime against the Palestinians and etc. because they were perceiving it as a defender. Then they turned against the Syrian regime because the Syrian regime was perceived as siding with the Palestinians and radical forces after the Camp David agreement. And then at the end of the war, the Syrian regime became the peacemaker in Lebanon against what was perceived the Christian interest, so they sided against it. So in fact, it's a constant oscillation. Now, this Christian dilemma of choosing in a way, and it's a deadly choice, I think, it's a deadly dilemma between the Sunni forces in the region and the Shia forces in the region, to put it very simplistically, is, I think, something of a suicidal choice for the Christians. They should step outside this choice, not be apathetic, but be probably more of a bridge builder between the two than siding with one of the two, because siding with one of the two will ultimately lead to their destruction, because one of the two is going to win, ultimately, and the winning of one of the two will really turn against the Christians that chose the other one. So, in fact, it's a very deadly choice, and I don't share it personally. But let's say that today the Christians of Lebanon are probably torn half and half between defending, sometimes against their deep conviction, the Syrian regime, understanding Hezbollah's action in Lebanon. Some of them are very enthusiastic towards that, under the label of, okay, this regime is awful, but after all, it's better than Sunni radicals and etc. And others are saying, after all, as Christians who are believers in the cause of freedom, maybe democracy one day, people's emancipation and etc., this regime has been terrible. Syrian population have revolted. We have to side with these people and bet that in the long run, kind of pluralism and democracy will reign over the region. It's maybe naive, but it has at least the advantage of sticking to values and principles. So both are defendable on the ground of tactics and strategy. Now, of course, it's a political choice that is very costly and very risky, because the one that will lose within this half of the Christian community will lose not only maybe politically, but maybe will lose physically also.
So I want to return to this issue of international crisis that is growing here. I mean, I appreciate what you're saying about the multiple layers and how this thing has expanded from an internal conflict in Syria to having significant international implications. And so now we see a good number of states now intervening in this case. We have a lot of those in the region. We've mentioned Iran, obviously Saudi Arabia is engaged in some way, shape, or form. You mentioned mm-hmm. Russia, Turkey. But there's also this kind of spillover effect of a lot of refugees and displaced people leaving the region and heading toward Europe, and the Europeans and Americans now having to decide how and to what extent to intervene. They've been involved in some way, shape, or form, but nothing like what others in the region are. So what are we to make of all of that? Mm-hmm. This is a really growing crisis mm-hmm. in the extent that it's really expanding well beyond the region and including players from all around the world. Yeah. And what do we expect of that?
You know, it's very easy 4 or 5 years later to say we have said it, in the beginning. But in fact, we have said it. I mean, people like Josh Landis, me, any other so-called expert on the Middle East and on Syria have said since the beginning that if this fire is not extinguished quite quickly and this conflict really solved or confined to an acceptable level, it will become unbearable and unmanageable on regional levels and maybe on international levels. We've been saying that, and you can find the traces of what has been written. And no one wanted to hear about that. And here I'm quite severe and harsh on the U.S. administration. I'm not talking about intervention or not, but the Obama rationale that was saying, in fact, we can't do anything about Syria. What we have to do is confine it and probably contain it in its own limit and then wait for it to extinguish, has proven completely wrong, because this conflict cannot be contained. And we all knew that it could not be contained because, first of all, Syria was a kind of appealing case for every other conflict in the region, the Iranian conflict with the Gulf and the Iranian, let's say, show of force with the West on the background of the nuclear agreement that was solved ultimately, Turkey versus Iran, Turkey versus other Arab states, Arab states versus Arab states, Sunnis against Shias, Russia wanting to play a role on the international scene that has nothing to do, in fact, with Syria. All of this was, in fact, sunk and pumped into the Syrian conflict. On the reverse side, Syria was also the generator of a lot of conflict. It is generating refugees. It is generating conflictuality and tension in Lebanon, probably in Turkey, maybe tomorrow in Jordan, and it has a link with Iraq. We have not to forget that ISIS, this famous ISIS that we are talking about today, came from Iraq, not in Syria, and then it brewed in Syria, and then it grew up in Syria. So all these, and anybody who knows a little bit about the Middle East knows that nothing can be contained within borders. So this is a way of saying that probably today to reshrink the conflict towards a Syrian level and towards Syria and contain it and maybe extinguish it, international community has to be much bolder in its approach. And today, in a way, subcontracting the conflict to the Russian intervention today in the hope that the Russians will pull out a rabbit of the hat and put a political solution on the table is once again, after 5 years, a new naiveness in a very long series of other naivenesses.
Well, Joseph, thank you so much for being here today and shedding light once again on this very complicated situation we're facing in the Middle East. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thanks.
You've been listening to our conversation with Joseph Pahut about the effect Syria's civil war has had on Lebanon. You can find more information about his work at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Geneva Center for Security Policy on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews with support from the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Our producer, Sam Dupre, and Brian Hardzinski edits the interviews, writes our web content, and handles our social media. You can follow us on Twitter, at WorldviewsKGOU. For Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Gorlott.